Sometimes, evil sneaks into your home.
She had lots of visitors. They just kind of used it as a party spot.
And sometimes, it's already there.
They had a bond, really sick, twisted bond.
And when strangers become roommates, blood will be spilled.
Bam.
This was a vengeance killing.
One word, overkill.
On April 6th, 2010, Drew Pyatt arrives home to a horrific sight. His house is on fire. He rushes to the closest convenience store to call 911.
Stockton Fire responds, and they gain entry to the house. And as they're extinguishing the fire, they realize that there is a dead body there.
But whose body is it? Investigators don't know if this is a terrible accident or a brutal murder. It's nothing that anyone living in this seemingly happy house would ever have seen coming. Only 3 months earlier, the house is a quiet shelter for 51-year-old Drew Pyatt.
Drew is kind of a blue-collar, hardworking guy, mows lawns for a living, doing landscaping. He rents the house from his mother.
His mom is involved in real estate, well-to-do family.
Drew and his mom invite 25-year-old Valerie Nessler to live there rent-free because she's a friend of the family.
Drew was just trying to be nice. He had the room and knew she didn't have the money to pay for the room, so he let her stay at the house.
Valerie was a patient of Drew's father. He was a doctor here in Stockton, and Drew became friends with her.
Valerie's a handful. Like, she really is. She has a heart of gold, very loving, very kind. She's just one of a kind.
Drew may have welcomed Valerie, but his mom doesn't want anyone else living there. The house is in Stockton, California, a city known mainly for its dark corners.
Stockton is one of the biggest cities to claim bankruptcy. It has a lot of socioeconomic problems with drug use, with gangs, with prostitution.
In the recent statistics, it was determined that Stockton, or San Joaquin County, the county in which Stockton is the second most violent per capita county in the state of California, behind Alameda County, which includes Oakland, California.
Luckily for Drew and Valerie, their house on Sussex Way in North Stockton is in a nice part of town.
It's a nice neighborhood. You know, the lawns are watered and mowed. You know, there are trees in the neighborhood. It's a middle-class neighborhood. You would feel fairly comfortable walking, you know, the street, even at nighttime, I would say.
The house was a standard California subdivision house. Three-bedroom, two-bath, two-car garage, lot size probably eighth of an acre, you know, nice front yard, well-landscaped, backyard well-landscaped.
The house soon becomes a refuge for one more, 48-year-old Jeffrey Wheatley. He's broken up with a serious girlfriend, and after months of living in and out of hotel rooms, Drew offers him a place to stay, despite his mom's wishes.
So Jeff, by, you know, circumstances, found himself in Stockton, and through sort of a, you know, partying and social contacts, came in contact with Drew, who had this house where he was, you know, had rooms to rent.
He had a room of his own, and I think it was that he was really feeling good.
Jeff is looking for a new start here. His life has been filled with ups and downs. Growing up in San Jose, Jeff drops out of high school at 17. And at his mother's urging, he enlists in the United States Coast Guard.
He absolutely embraced the military. He was able to go forward and get his GED, his general education diploma. He just blossomed.
You loved being able to call us and say, I'm in Kodiak, Alaska, or I'm in Astoria, Oregon, or, you know, I'm in Juneau. He loved that. And I just think he really found a brotherhood there.
Things go well for Jeff until a series of accidents changes things. It all starts the day he has a serious fall on deck.
He had a very severe knee injury. The Coast Guard sent him to Seattle. They did the first of his knee surgeries there. He went back to the Coast Guard and was in a helicopter incident, and it re-injured his knee, which was already in bad shape. So he had to leave the Coast Guard.
He's honorably discharged, but doesn't know what to do with his life. He tries working in restaurants and then driving trucks for a living. Then he goes back to school in Jasper, Georgia, to become a nurse.
Jeff was really smart. He's graduated at the top of his class.
But he doesn't stay a nurse long.
Well, first of all, in the Deep South, if you're not a woman and you're a nurse, then there's a real question of your sexuality. And that certainly wasn't part of Jeff's psyche. It bothered him no end, and he didn't stay with it.
Jeff's larger-than-life appearance earns him the nickname Half-Ton.
He was 6'4", 6'5", big man. But he had this aura about him. And when he spoke, I knew he was the not-so-tough guy. He was very soft-spoken and very gentle. And he was very kind. And he had very kind, beautiful brown eyes. We used to feed the homeless people all the time. That was a high priority on his list, that we would give them food, we would give them money, we would buy them meals in restaurants if they were in there having a cup of coffee. He would tell a waitress, buy that guy anything he wants and put it on my tab. He loved people and he cared about people.
He was a big guy, looked intimidating, but he was a teddy bear.
Jeff! I need your help!
Yeah, coming.
When he moves in with Drew in January 2010, all goes well with the three roommates.
Try not to get any on the skin.
Jeff and Valerie especially hit it off.
Drew, you're home! Look, Half-Ton's giving me a pedicure.
You're running a beauty parlor, Jeff.
Gotta start somewhere.
Jeff liked her, and he gave her a pedicure.
That tickles. Oh, no.
He found a little puppy wandering the streets, and he brought it in.
Oh, my God, what do you have there?
He had a real soft spot for animals and children.
I think maybe somebody needs a bath.
Oh, yes, I'll help you.
All right.
They shampooed it together in the bathtub and gave it a bath.
Let's go wash you, puppy.
But soon, the close friendship will deteriorate. Valerie is hiding secrets.
When she lost him, she just lost everything.
And so is Jeff.
Bam!
Valerie heard Jeffrey brag about doing a murder.
Former U.S. Coast Guard Jeff Wheatley has just moved into a new home in a nice suburb of Stockton, California. Along with the room come two housemates, his landlord, Drew Pyatt, and a young woman named Valerie Nessler. The housemates get along very well, at first.
Oh. So jumpy.
You scared me.
Didn't mean to.
There's three roommates and living in a house, have a good time, and they would party, and all accounts are that everything got along, you know, very, very well.
How about a piece of that lovely cake?
Of course.
Maybe even too well. Jeff likes Valerie a lot.
Oh, that woman would make any man fall for her so hard.
Like a glass of milk with that?
Yeah, I'd love one.
And so does Drew, even though he has a girlfriend. Perhaps part of Valerie's charm is that she hasn't had the easiest life.
You know, guys want to help a damsel in distress, and perhaps they wanted to help her in that regard.
She's originally from a rougher neighborhood.
Valerie grew up in the east side of Stockton, where everybody knows everybody. East Side is an unincorporated area of San Joaquin County. It abuts the city of Stockton. It's on the other side of the San Joaquin. There's a big wash there. It's kind of always been its own little entity.
I met Valerie in third grade. She was my very first friend. Pretty much the only person that talked to me in class. And we've been friends ever since. We were like Bonnie and Clyde, Thelma and Louise. She was my everything. When I couldn't hold up my own chin, she held it up for me. She's always the one if I need somebody to talk to. I can go straight to her.
And her life's even tougher than the neighborhood she grew
Dad?
Up in.
Dad? Oh, my God. Dad! Oh, my God! No! Dad!
She was living with her father when he committed suicide.
He was her whole world. She was a daddy's girl. And when she lost him, she just lost everything.
She was alone for a while. I think she bounced back and forth with other family members because her mother was unable to care for her.
Despite the tragedy, Valerie always had big plans.
Valerie always wanted to be a judge. Worked at the courthouse, pushing paper.
But only a year after her father's death, another tragedy derails her ambition.
She got pregnant with Chloe, kind of brought back the light in her eyes. And when her daughter passed away of SIDS, Valerie just was gone.
Maybe we should put Chloe back.
No, 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 it's my baby.
She was just there.
My baby.
Not really even existing. There's so many times I would have to hold her on the ground while she was screaming that she just wanted to die.
She needs me.
And they told her she'd never have kids again. So she lost her one and only.
It doesn't take long before it's obvious Jeff, Valerie, and Drew are three very different people.
Drew kept the house really nice. Everything was pretty orderly. Jeff's room was immaculate.
I think it was his Coast Guard background. He was kind of a neat freak, kept his room very tidy.
Come on, Val.
From what I understand, Valerie was pretty much the opposite.
Valerie's room was a disaster. Dirty clothes everywhere, an absolute pigsty.
Jeffrey spends most of his time repairing an old truck, which he sees as a way to start again.
He was restoring an old truck that my father had bought for him. And I really think he was in a good place. And I think that his goal was to find employment after he had transportation.
Val!
Halftime! Hey, everyone! Halftime's here!
Woo! Valerie, on the other hand, right. is the life of the party.
She had lots of visitors. They were in and out of that house a lot. They just kind of used it as a party spot.
The parties are a magnet for Valerie's friends, especially for A.J. Perriman yep. and her ex, Robert Turner.
Valerie was longtime friends with Robert Turner.
Robert and Valerie knew each other from the east side of Stockton.
Like Valerie, Robert has a tragic story in his past. His brother Moose died young.
In 1994, Moose was found dead in a room from a gunshot to the head. It actually went up through the bottom of his chin, up to the top of his head. It was ruled a accidental self-discharged death. It wasn't a suicide, but he was messing around with a gun and shot himself.
Robert and his family are convinced that he was murdered.
They never accepted it. They always believed it was some outlaw motorcycle gang, like a Hell's Angel type hit for drugs.
Jeff and Robert meet at one of Valerie's parties.
Oh, hey, this is my new roommate, Jeff. Jeff, this is Robert. I've known him forever.
Hey, man, nice to meet you.
The roommate, right?
You bet.
Hey,
you want a beer?
Oh, no, I'm good. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Oh, hey, Robert. Come on. come to my room.
Wait,
I have to show
you. Where you want
to
go?
Come on.
It seems that Jeff isn't happy that Robert and Valerie are spending so much time together.
If she wanted a certain person, she didn't stop till she had him. If she knew she could have him, she didn't want him. At all.
Jeff has no reason to be jealous of Robert. He already has a girlfriend, Valerie's best friend, Amber Melendez.
Robert was very family-oriented when it came to me and my kids. The way his stance, the way he walks, he always has some weird expression on his face, very comical. And I was like, you're just, no, I'm cool. But he turned out to be a little pretty boy. Loves to joke around. The one that, if you're not having a good day, he will make you laugh and you don't want to. He fixed me. He took me out of a really abusive relationship and showed me that men don't hit women. He opened the doors when they needed to be opened. He was really caring, very lovable.
They've been dating for months. Amber knows Robert's been spending a lot of time with Valerie lately, but she also knows they're old friends. Besides, she trusts Robert. Valerie relies on the couple for support, and late one night, she reaches out with some shocking news.
Hello?
Amber! Amber! I've been attacked!
As he got involved in drugs, his behavior changed.
He at one time claimed to have been part of an outlaw motorcycle gang.
Valerie Messler has been living with her new roommates, Drew Pyatt and Jeff Wheatley, for 2 months. When she calls up her best friend, Amber Melendez, with a shocking story. She's been sexually assaulted at the house.
Amber! Amber! I've been attacked! She said that she had woke up to just feeling touched. Her pants down to her ankles, her shirt pulled up. She said at first that she thought it was a dream that she couldn't wake up from.
What's worse, Valerie says the offender lives in the house.
It was Jeff. Jeff, yes, my roommate.
As it turns out, Jeff has some painful secrets. It all starts with his knee injury.
I remember him calling me once and telling me that he used to have to sleep in the bathtub so he could pour hot water over his legs at night because he was in that much pain.
At first, doctors give him painkillers to help him cope. But when he develops an addiction, they stop.
The doctors cut off his prescriptions. They put him on painkillers with his knee surgeries, and then they cut him off. And so he had no access to anything but street drugs. But he didn't use a lot, but he only used enough to curb his pain.
By the time he moves into the house, he's been using for 3 years, and it's taken a toll on his relationships.
As he got involved in drugs, his behavior changed. It instantly formed a wall between Jeffrey and I.
Worst yet, he may be involved with a criminal gang.
He at one time claimed to have been part of an outlaw motorcycle gang. He had mentioned that to his roommate, Drew Pyatt.
It's Jeff, you raped me!
Amber doesn't know what to make of Valerie's phone call.
It's weird, because I wasn't sure to believe her.
She knows that Valerie can be dramatic at times.
Valerie liked to cause drama between people. I think it was more for attention. You had to know Valerie to know how far the drama was gonna go.
Is Robert there? Give me Robert, please. I need to talk to Robert.
Who's he? Yeah.
Robert doesn't leap to Valerie's rescue. He's used to her antics by now.
I'll see you tomorrow, okay?
Robert!
Next, Valerie calls the father of her child, Ron. He gets upset, but she convinces him to drop it. She admits she's not completely sure what happened. Daily life in the house appears to carry on as usual, but there's something brewing under the surface.
There was, you know, obviously some tension in the household, you know, centered around Valerie.
The tension ratchets up even more one night while she and Jeff are alone.
That guy is sexy.
Really? I think that guy is sexy. I killed a guy once.
You killed a guy?
Yeah.
Valerie heard Jeffrey speak about or brag about doing a murder. He said that he shot the person in the head.
Bam! Right in the face.
Meanwhile, Drew is starting to get pissed off, too.
Hey, you! I know you're selling meth! You gotta stop or you gotta get out!
What are you talking about?
Drew told us that he suspected that Jeff was selling low-level narcotics. He didn't want that in his house because it was his mom's house, and that he had confronted Jeff about that to either quit or to leave.
But before Drew makes good on his threat, he gets a strange phone call.
Hello?
He got a warning to get out of the house because, you know, bad things were coming.
That night, he stays out with his girlfriend until close to midnight.
Into the early morning hours of April 7th, Drew returned to the house, saw that the house was on fire.
Oh, what the? What the?
He races to a convenience store down the street, where he calls 911.
I need to use your phone. It's an emergency.
Stockton Fire responds, and they gain entry to the house. And as they're putting out this fire, they realize that there is a body there. They immediately freeze the residents and call Stockton Police Department.
We responded to the location up on Sussex Avenue, and we began our investigation. The fire was considered suspicious, and there was also a larger crime scene inside the house.
Investigators immediately stumble onto something odd.
We found a bag near the front door, not far from the body.
In that trash bag was a sawed-off shotgun with two expended 12-gauge shotgun shells, two knives that had blood on them. They appeared to be kitchen knives, and a lot of men's clothing.
What happened in this Stockton house? And whose burned body is found in the entrance?
The medical examiner for San Joaquin County described it, one word, overkill.
There was blood. Literally just everywhere, pools of blood.
Firefighters respond to a 911 call at Drew Pyatt's Stockton home. Investigators immediately suspect foul play. At the scene, police officers find a sawed-off shotgun, two knives with blood on them, men's clothing, and a pair of latex gloves. Nearby, a charred body. It's Jeff Wheatley. The police are able to identify him by his fingerprints and tattoos.
His body was traumatized. Approximately a third to his body was burned away.
His family gets the call just hours later.
I received a phone call late in the night from my mother. And she said to me, I know if I'm calling this late, you know it's not good news. So I said, is it my grandmother? And she said, no, honey, it's Jeff. And then I heard her say the word homicide. It's the worst thing ever. I had to call my father. I had to call my sisters, my son. It was awful.
Sadder still, the police discover that not only has Jeff been burned alive, he was also shot twice and stabbed 32 times.
He had a lot of blood on his head and shoulders from a gunshot wound, a shotgun wound. And he had numerous stab wounds throughout his torso. There was blood literally just everywhere, pools of blood, footprints in blood, handprints in blood, smears of blood.
Well, it's one of the most brutal attacks I've ever investigated. I've been a police officer for 21 years, and this is the top five, you know, maybe the number one for brutality.
By the sheer brutality of it. This was a vengeance killing. This is someone who was highly motivated, who was personal. This was not some, you know, random shooting where you just shoot a guy one time. This was something very personal.
The medical examiner for San Joaquin County described it in one word, overkill.
The police start piecing together the evidence. First, they interview Drew. He made the call and was the first one in the house.
Drew at first was a little evasive.
Things don't look good for him. There is gasoline found all over the house, as well as an empty gas can.
The gas can was a gas can that he used in the garage for his lawnmower equipment.
But he doesn't know anything about the body.
He was unaware that somebody was found inside.
He doesn't tell the cops about the warning call he got, but his girlfriend does.
We had the advantage of speaking to his girlfriend, who was with him at the time, prior to speaking to him. We confronted him with that, and after a short time, he decided to tell us more of the truth.
I was in fear of my life.
He was worried that if he did call the police, that whoever was coming for Jeffrey would come after him.
Who gave you that warning? It was Valerie.
And she is nowhere to be found.
So we want to know, is she dead? Did the people that do this take her, go kill her? Is she in a ditch somewhere? So our first order of business is to find Valerie.
Later that day, they track her down at her mother's house over on the east side, and they bring her in for questioning. They don't tell her there's been a murder or that they know she called Drew to warn him.
Everybody's a suspect. You know, when you got a crime, you know, you can't just focus on one person. You focus on all potential suspects and interview everybody, and you start eliminating them.
They question her about Jeff.
Tell me who Jeffrey Wheatley is.
What do you want to know? He's my roommate. We don't talk much. But I'm pretty sure that's not his real name.
Almost right away, she tells police she believes Jeff Wheatley was an alias.
That guy's name is Joe. It's not Jeff, okay?
Valerie Nestler decided that Jeffrey Wheatley was indeed someone named Joe Wheeler, and that this Joe Wheeler had done something really terrible.
He's not a good guy.
And to prove that Jeff was a suspicious character, she tells the police she was sexually assaulted.
And then I feel someone touching me.
She did tell me a story about using drugs and alcohol one night in the home, and she woke up to another person fondling her.
But she changes the story. She says that one of Jeff's friends molested her and that he failed to protect her. Then they ask her if she knows anything about what happened in the house.
There was a fire. That's what my mom told me.
From the beginning, she minimized her involvement to having very little knowledge.
The police think she knows more than she's letting on.
We're conducting a murder investigation.
What? Are you serious? Who is murdered?
We're getting to that. Drew told us about the signal.
And that's when she learns why she's been brought in. They know about the phone call to Drew.
Drew received warnings from Valerie saying that there were some people that were angry with Jeff, and they were coming for him, and that he should not be there.
Upset, Drew relayed this information to Jeff.
Listen, Jeff, somebody's coming after you. You gotta get the hell out of here.
According to Drew,
It's all good, man.
Jeff was unimpressed by that and didn't feel threatened by that and stayed at the house.
He just told Drew that he was okay, that things would be all right.
I don't know why Drew didn't call the police. Maybe he didn't think it was really going to happen. Maybe he thought it was just a lot of big talk from a lot of big talkers.
After being confronted about the phone call, Valerie starts to talk.
And then I hear a knock at the door.
She says, I was in the room, I hear a knock, and two guys come busting through the door, and I am panicky and I flee.
We confronted her that she knew more and she knew their true identity.
We ask her, you know, who came in, do you recognize them, voices, stuff like that. And she leads us through the conversation to Alan.
I think his last name was Perriman.
Alan Perriman, also known as AJ, is one of Valerie's acquaintances.
I've seen him a handful of times before all of this. And every single time it was very pleasant. He'd come over for dinner, very respectful. Yes, ma'am, thank you. He loved kids. I remember waking up one day and he's watching SpongeBob with my son, crawling all over the floor, telling him, come on, little buddy, you can do it. Stand up, you can walk.
The police press her for the other man's name.
From the neighborhood, they call him Nico, I think.
Valerie claims that the other man in the house that night was someone named Nico. She insists she didn't do anything wrong.
After about 2-3 hours of interviewing, we let her go. We all kind of sat down and talked, you know what? This was a vengeance killing, and these kind of people don't leave witnesses. So why is Valerie alive? And we kind of went, hmm. So we investigate further, and we go after Alan.
The police arrest Alan Perriman early in the morning on April 13th. He claims he had nothing to do with the crime, and he has an alibi from the police themselves.
Lodi Police Department, which is a small city just to the north of Stockton, an officer had pulled over Alan's car because it was driving suspiciously, and the right front passenger foot bails and takes off. The officer searches the car and finds a methamphetamine pipe underneath the seat. The thing that's of interest there is when the officer searched the car, there was carpets in the car. There was carpets like you would have in any standard automobile.
But the carpets aren't there on the morning that Alan is arrested.
You only get rid of evidence and try to clean up your car if you're complicit in a crime.
At one point, he broke down a little bit. He was showing a lot of concern for his family. And at one point, he told us that if he did tell us the truth, he would be facing 25 to life.
The police push him for more details, but he refuses to say anything else.
Tell me about Nico.
I don't know that name, dude.
He's kept in custody. Later that same day, the cops interview Valerie a second time. This time, she admits she didn't flee the scene.
Okay, I was there.
And even heard gunshots.
I was there.
In the course of that interview, she says, well, no, I didn't just flee. I stayed there because they told me if I say anything, if I do anything, you know, they're going to kill me. And I saw what they did.
And then she drops a bombshell. It wasn't Nico who killed Jeff. It was someone he knew, and someone she knew well, too.
That woman can't keep a secret to save her life.
I think they had a bond, really sick, twisted bond.
Police have one suspect in custody for the brutal murder of Jeff Wheatley, Alan Perriman. But they're desperate to identify his accomplice. So they bring Jeff's roommate, Valerie Nessler, in again. She's scared, but she's about to sing.
It was Robert. Robert Turner.
After a second interview with Valerie, she finally gave us Robert Turner's name.
Come here, I have to tell you something.
Just a couple of weeks before, she had told Robert about Jeff's murder confession.
It's about Moose.
Oh, what about Moose?
I know who killed him. Sit down. I know who killed him.
Who?
Jeff.
Jeff, not the teddy bear.
Yes, Jeff killed him. You have to believe me.
She associates the story that Jeff told her with basically him confessing to killing Robert's brother, Moose.
That woman can't keep a secret to save her life. And if she heard something, she had to run and tell somebody.
What are you gonna do about it?
I'll take care of it. Thanks.
I have no doubt that she told Robert this in hopes that there'd be drama surrounding her and she'd be the focus of whatever happened in the next couple days, next couple weeks.
When she spoke to Robert about it, he had eventually came over to the house and spoke with Jeff. They went into Jeff's room for about 15 to 30 minutes, and they came out smiling and laughing, and everything was good.
We're good, man.
Okay, well, sorry about that.
We'll see you soon.
Yeah, I'll see you later.
Then it was, you know, bygones be bygones, and everything was cool.
But the morning after the fire, Robert's girlfriend Amber doesn't remember him taking the news well. He was out the night before. And when he eventually comes home, he seems different.
He came home and he had duct tape wrapped around his finger. He called his brother.
Yeah, it's me.
And I just overheard them talking.
I was over there and it's taken care of. He can rest in peace now.
He said it's done. My brother can now rest in peace. I kind of put two and two together. And I didn't know what to think.
Amber knows Robert has a thing for fire.
I know.
He love fire. If he can burn anything, I don't care if it was a piece of paper. If he can catch it on fire, it was going. That was his thing. He was a pyro.
Robert may have played the family man to Amber, but he has a history of arson. He burned down a trailer to avenge his other brother, Bruce.
The facts of that case are that the owner of the trailer owed Robert Turner's brother some money, wasn't able to pay that money, and Robert set the trailer to fire as a revenge. He was prosecuted for arson and actually was arrested and convicted of arson up in Siskiyou County.
Amber knows a place where they can go while Robert figures out what to do.
I took him to a friend's house, and it wasn't because I was trying to take him and hide him. It was more I wanted to get through to him. He wanted to go suicide by cop. I wasn't gonna let that happen.
Police issue an APB for Robert Turner.
We didn't know where his whereabouts were, so we released it to the media.
We had done a kind of a full court press. We had released his photograph. We had police officers, U.S. Marshals, other law enforcement agencies trying to find Robert here. We were pulling out all the stops.
On April 17th, 11 days after the murder, he finally turns himself in.
He told me, let's do it. I'm gonna turn myself in. I opened the front doors. He walked in.
My name's Robert Turner. I'm turning myself in, don't shoot.
He was afraid more of getting caught than anybody else.
Even with two suspects in custody, 2 months later, the police are still trying to figure out how Valerie fits into the story.
You know, she was either a witness or a suspect. And we still kind of scratched our heads going, you know, if you're just a witness, you're an innocent witness, you're too much of a liability. And these guys don't care about killing somebody by look at what they just did to Jeff. You had to have done something to gain their trust.
But once the forensics come in, things become much more clear.
The latex gloves had on the point of one of the fingers a drop of blood. We got the analysis that the blood was that of Jeff, his DNA, and the DNA profile of the glove was of Valerie. So Valerie's wearing latex gloves with Jeff's blood on it.
What's that? I don't know what that is.
Armed with this new evidence, they bring Valerie back in for questioning on June 23rd for a third interview. Her story changes yet again.
Okay. Robert made me do it. I only did it a little bit.
She confesses that she stabbed Jeff, but claims she didn't attack him aggressively.
There was a black handle knife and a brown handle knife. Valerie admitted using the black handle knife, and we could match up several wounds to them. Those wounds were the more superficial wounds, like a woman who is stabbing, not as strong as a man. Based on that and the other evidence that we now had, we arrested Valerie, and she was suspect number three.
Their trial begins in July 2011. Valerie changes her story again and testifies that she only acted like she stabbed Jeff because she was afraid that Robert would hurt her and her family. It's hard to believe her latest story, especially after the authorities discover a kite, jailhouse lingo for note that Robert gave to Valerie.
He sent her a kite, passed it to her on their way into the trial. She secreted it away in her vagina, and the matron saw it happen, retrieved it. Valerie never read it, but it was read in court, and he proclaimed his love for her as a sister and that he would fall on the sword. He wanted $5,000 put into his account in prison. Her whole defense was that she was terrified of Robert Turner, and yet they sat at the same defense table and laughed together and touched each other. I think they had a bond, really sick, twisted bond.
They were friends and ex-lovers. She had an alliance or allegiance to Robert.
The prosecution paints a different picture of what they think really happened that night.
Jeff was ambushed. Valerie Nestler was sending text messages to inform Robert Turner and Alan Perriman of Jeff's whereabouts inside the house. Her last text to him was, "He's in the." That's as far as she got, and he broke down the door.
Robert came through the door, shot him twice with a shotgun. Jeff had a birdshot on the side of his face, and then he had a second shot on his shoulder.
A fight ensued. Jeffrey was injured, but not incapacitated.
While this is going on, Alan stands guard at the door.
Every indication is that Alan was the guard, making sure no one leaves, making sure no one comes in.
Ah, get in here! Get a knife!
In the kitchen, there was a drawer that had the kitchen knives. Valerie and Robert then took those knives. And later, the autopsy determined that he had 32 stab wounds throughout his body.
And the three of them walked away from him. And they saw Jeff up on his feet, trying to get out the front door. AJ ran up, tackled Jeff. When they're killing Jeff at the front door, Valerie was more worried about a small dog that was barking. For the fear of the dog getting hurt by one of the other suspects, she ran to protect the dog. So it just shows me that there was no value of life there. While he's on the ground, somebody retrieved a gallon gas can. They doused Jeffrey with gas. Moments later, they lit him on fire while he was alive.
It's never officially determined who lit the fire, but once it catches, all three panic. They flee in Alan's car before they're stopped by police in Lodi.
You guys don't say my name. Just shut your mouths.
Where Robert makes his escape on foot. For Jeff's family attending the trial, hearing the details is extremely difficult.
It was devastating. I saw weapons. I saw crime scene photos. I saw autopsy photos. As bad as I thought it was worse. He was tortured.
Brutal. There's no other way you can describe it. It's brutal.
He fought really hard. He tried to make it out of that house so badly. He really tried to survive.
The prosecution explains the motive for killing Jeff.
Robert, a seeking revenge, in his mind, it's clear to him that, you know, Jeff has killed his brother Moose 15 years ago, and now Jeff's got to pay.
I think she didn't get the reaction she wanted with the whole he touched me thing. So I think she took the one thing that she knew would get to Robert, and that was his brother.
The irony is that there's no way that Jeff could have killed Robert's brother back in 1994.
He was actually stationed in Atlanta, Georgia, at the time of Moose's death. So there's no way that Jeff could have participated in that killing. There's it's an impossible.
Jeff loved to brag. He loved to tell a big story, and he had tons of them. Problem is, Jeff would have bragged about helping someone. He would have bragged about saving someone. He never would have bragged about hurting anybody. He was a big softy, a big teddy bear, soft heart.
He loved people and he cared about people. And I know he would never hurt anybody. I refuse to believe that. That's not who he is.
That's a little difficult to swallow, something like that. I don't know for a fact, but I don't believe that he ever said that in those words. I do not believe that Jeffrey would ever say that.
There's also no proof that Jeff was part of a criminal gang, that he was dealing drugs, or that he ever assaulted Valerie.
Valerie liked to be the center of attention. She had to be everybody's number one. Everybody's. She could be your best friend or your worst enemy. And it was all up to you on which one she was going to be.
That I'd still have my brother. If Valerie Nestler hadn't decided to play games using people.
Robert Turner and Valerie Nestler are found guilty of first-degree murder in July 2011. Valerie is given 26 years to life in prison, while Robert is given life without the possibility of parole. In the fall, Alan Perriman is found guilty of second-degree murder and is sentenced to 16 years to life.
The jury came back with verdicts in about 45 minutes, which in a special circumstance case is unheard of. Every one of their sentences reflect their level of culpability. So I truly believe justice was done in this case.
I'm not a proponent of the death penalty, but I do have to say it crossed my mind. But I'm glad that I prefer life without parole. So I'm glad that that's what Turner got. I absolutely feel that Valerie Nestler should have gotten the same thing. A.J. Perriman should have gotten more time also.
He was a good person. He loved animals. He loved his friends. He was just trying to live Jeffrey's life.
I have a little fountain in my backyard that I made, that we built. And I have a granite rock with Jeffrey's name inscribed on it. And I sit, have a cocktail, and sit out by the pond and toast him. And I have moments. Both my sisters and I, we all three share this. When we see a Harley, we see a big guy on a Harley, we have little moments where you can smile and think about him and just miss him without having to associate it with all of this horribleness, where we just miss him.
Thank you.